Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusea in for Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's the lead of a brief article in the Las Vegas Sun from July 15th, 2002. A 16-year-old Las Vegas boy jumped to his death after he scaled two fences on the 109th floor of the Stratosphere Tower Saturday night.
Now, the teenager's name was Levi Presley. After his suicide, writer John DeGatta composed a story about Levi for Harper's Magazine, and the editors at Harper's found some factual inaccuracies and rejected the piece.
The piece later went to The Believer, another magazine, and they assigned one of their interns to fact-check the story, Jim Fingle, who lives in Cambridge. What followed was a 7-year correspondence between Fingle and the writer, DeGatta. In short, Fingle found factual problems with nearly every sentence of DeGatta's piece, and DeGatta's response, so what?
That, along with the original essay and Jim Fingle's copious fact-checking notes, comprise the new book, The Lifetime of a Fact. And the book is much more than just an essay and errata. It's an exploration of the art of storytelling, our expectations as readers, and the relationship between fact and truth.
Jim Fingle, the fact checker, joins us now in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
And John DeGatta, the author, joins us from Florida. Hi, John.
Hi.
And I'd like to start off this conversation just giving listeners a sense of how this book works. So you, John, I wonder if you could read the first paragraph from your original essay about Levi Presley's death.
Sure.
Take it away.
On the same day in Las Vegas when 16-year-old Levi Presley jumped from the observation deck of the 1,149-foot-high tower of the Stratosphere Hotel and Casino, lap dancing was temporarily banned by the city in 34 licensed strip clubs in Vegas. Archaeologists unearthed shards of the world's oldest bottle of Tabasco brand sauce from beneath a local bar called Buckets of Blood, and a woman from Mississippi beat a chicken named Ginger in a 35-minute-long game of tic-tac-toe.
That's great. Thanks, Jim. So, John, the author, Jim, the fact-checker. We're going to keep it straight. That was John, the author. Jim, the fact-checker, you were assigned to check the accuracy of all of the claims in that sentence and all of the ones that followed. For instance, you found that the Stratosphere is, in fact, 1,149 feet tall, but you found inaccuracies as well. For example, you found that the 34 licensed strip clubs was actually 31, and the bar under which the oldest Tabasco bottle was found wasn't called Buckets of Blood, but rather was a Virginia City bar called, strangely enough, Boston Saloon. You also found that that 35-minute tic-tac-toe game with Ginger the Chicken did not, in fact, happen the same day as Levi's suicide, but it actually happened a full month later. So, Jim and John, I'm hoping that you can pick up and read us through your correspondence as it appears in the book. Pick it up there with after we hear about Ginger the Chicken. Jim, you go first. Jim, the fact-checker.
Sure. Hey, John, again. I was wondering if you could weigh in on this tic-tac-toe... I was wondering if you could weigh in on this tic-tac-toe game with the chicken. It looks like it happened quite a bit after Levi Presley died, but also that the woman who won it wasn't really from Mississippi. I think she was a local resident. Does this matter?
I realize that, but I need her to be from a place other than Las Vegas in order to underscore the transient nature of the city, that nearly everyone in Vegas is from someplace else. And since she did, in fact, originally come from Mississippi, I think the claim is fine as it is.
What about the fact that this didn't occur on the same day Presley died? It's not accurate to say that it did.
I would say it's a part of the atmosphere of that particular summer.
Then isn't that how it should be framed so that it's more accurate?
No, because being more precise would be less dramatic and would sound a lot clunkier. I don't think readers will care whether the events that I'm discussing happened on the same day, a few days apart, or a few months apart. What most readers will care about, I think, is the meaning that's suggested in the confluence of these events, that no matter how far apart they occurred, the facts are being employed here to function not baldly as facts, but rather as image-based things, more than information. Nobody is going to read this, in other words, in order to get a survey of the demographics of Las Vegas or what's scheduled on the community calendar. Readers can get that kind of information elsewhere.
That's writer John DeGatta and his one-time fact-checker Jim Fingal reading from their correspondence over a piece that John wrote for The Believer. Their extensive dialogue is compiled in a new book called The Lifespan of a Fact. Jim, the fact checker, did John's explanation there hold water for you at the time?
Well, as a fact checker, those sorts of explanations, I guess, are immaterial to the job at hand.
Right.
You know, whether or not the author intended to make things inaccurate or it's an accident, or whether or not it's entirely fiction, the task is the same: to, you know, break down every possible verifiable or supportable fact and find sources for them.
But this clearly went so far beyond the job at hand for you. This went extracurricular with you real quick, I imagine. I mean, this became an argument between two people, not two professionals.
I think that the it turned into a debate between John and I, going beyond the fact-checking.
So now, you know, a few years later, how do you take John's argument that he just presented?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, the role that I was playing as a fact checker is in some ways a very extreme position to take, because it's one that is one about evidence, and is there's not a lot of room for fudging in that. Whereas, you know, me as a private citizen, I think there are interesting questions about genre and about, you know, what is appropriate in different sorts of writing.
All right, well, let's get into that. John, the author, you can tell from your correspondence right at the top of the book that you were resistant to the very notion that someone had been assigned to fact-check your piece. Can you explain why?
Well, I had already gone through this, as you explained, with Harper's.
Right.
They had already started fact-checking. And so in some ways, I was prepared when I was told that that Jim would be fact-checking the essay. But what I was amazed by and what I wasn't prepared for was the document that Jim produced, which was, I doubt Harper's would want this revealed, but was about 1,000 times more thorough than what their fact-checker produced. It was, I think the essay as a manuscript was something like 20 pages long, and the document that Jim produced in response to it detailing all of the inaccuracies was over 100 pages long. So it was overwhelming, and it was certainly surprising, and it made me angry, it made me embarrassed, but it also kind of delighted me and amazed me, because I think the document is an astounding illustration of this very issue, of the conflict between the facts that some readers want and expect from a nonfiction text and the liberties that some quote-unquote nonfiction writers feel that they need to take to create more deeply truthful experiences for the reader.
Well, John, you bristle at the application of the word nonfiction to your essay in the course of your correspondence with Jim, and yet you used it with us just now. I'm wondering if this is all a problem of classification. Can you make the distinction between the terms essay and nonfiction as genres? Can you unpack those for us as what they mean to you?
Sure. You know, I've been surprising myself over the past couple of weeks as we've been chatting with readers, because nonfiction is the term that we all use in our culture. But when I'm home and in class with my students, I actually put a moratorium on the term nonfiction because it doesn't accurately describe what we're doing. In fact, it describes nothing. The term is a negation of any genre. Nonfiction coming obviously from fiction, which comes from the Latin fictio, which means to shape, to arrange, to mold, which is fundamentally, I think, an activity in any form of art, not just fiction, not just literature. It's what we expect from art, to take the raw material of the world and to shape it in order to find the significance in it. And so a term that is not that, a term that tries to describe a text or a work of literature that's not about shaping or not about arranging is problematic for me because it robs the genre of the opportunity to do what art is supposed to do. And it's a very young term, too. We've only been using it for maybe 60 years. While all this time, in fact, for the past 500 years, we've had this term essay, which is itself a little problematic because when we say essay, we all probably cringe because we remember those things we had to write in high school or college. But that too is a more recent understanding of the essay. An essay as a term and as a literary thing was invented by a writer named Michel de Montaigne in the 16th century in France, and he applied this French word, essay, to this text because for him what it meant was an attempt. The word means literally a test, a trial, an experiment. There's no promise in that term of verifiability or of, you know, reportage. It's merely a promise that the mind on the page is going to grapple with some issue, with some idea or some emotion.
So listeners, we're talking about truth and storytelling. Aside from your general reactions to what you're hearing, I wonder, what do you expect when you sit down to read a story about real life events, as was the case with this essay that we're talking about? Do you assume journalistic accuracy? Is the writer allowed to take some license? And are your expectations different for the medium? I'm thinking of movies like the ones Oliver Stone makes. Nobody expects his Nixon biopic to be a historically accurate account, though they do expect it to get at some kind of underlying truth. I'm wondering, is Hollywood able to get away with stuff that print writers can't? We could take a couple of calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Jim, the fact checker. It seems in reading your correspondence, what bothers you is not this idea that John is writing an essay and it is perhaps a fictionalized or embellished account. What seems to bother you is the fact that the language that he's using sort of it presents itself as a first-person journalistic account. And what you want is sort of truth in advertising. Is that a fair characterization of your argument?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think if we think the problem is of categorization and of expectation, there's a bit of misdirection there, where if it sort of looks like journalism and sounds like journalism, a reader is gonna come to it expecting certain things, and if they don't have the same understanding as the author or even those who publish it, there's conflict there, and there's an opportunity for people to feel misled.
And John, the author, I mean, I gather that a thrust of your work as a writer, something that you're interested in, is sort of confounding reader expectations. And which strikes me as a perfectly valid artistic endeavor. So I wonder, Jim, Jim the fact checker, you both have J names, I got to keep this straight. Jim the fact checker, I wonder if a lot of the kind of ire that you direct toward John in your correspondence is problems that could have been resolved just with a really great preface from your editor at The Believer explaining to the reader what they're about to read and giving them context for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the ire is that the fact checker's job is in some ways it's the boring job. It's the more rules based job. While my job is to stick to the facts and the more epistemological rules, John gets more artistic freedom. So maybe some of the frustration in there comes from that, and also because the piece was presented to The Believer, knowing what sort of text it was, and my job was to check it, though there wasn't any guarantee that anything was going to happen because of that, other than the magazine knowing which things were inaccurate.
I should say that you were an unpaid intern when you were doing this work, right?
That's true.
Okay, so imagine Employers out there, imagine how fastidious this guy is when he's on the clock. Anyways, okay, let's take a call. Bill is calling from Walpole. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
What's your thought?
Well, in 1968, Butch Cassidy started with "Most of what follows is true." And today that's kind of been leveled out as based on a true story. And so Hollywood takes a single fact and turns it into whatever they want. I don't think viewers are really content with that, but it's kind of what we have now.
It's an interesting thought, Bill. And John, the author, I really think that kind of the illustrative comparison here is with film, is with movies. Because, like, we expect that we're going to get a story that's when a movie is based on a true story, we don't expect that it's going to be a journalistically accurate account. We expect it's going to get at the truth of the matter, but we know that, you know, the words that we're hearing in the conversations we're seeing didn't happen, or maybe they happened in other situations and were compressed. Do you feel like you're being held to an unfair standard that other types of artists aren't held to?
In some ways, yes, the genre is, but it's also understandable. I mean, there's an issue in literature in general in that we come to it with different expectations. Poets have been bemoaning, or even transgressive fiction writers have been bemoaning the apparent inability of readers to grapple with the sorts of experiments that were done, you know, half a century ago in Cubism. You know, when we see a painting of a woman with her eyeballs on her arm, we don't flip out and you know, feel betrayed by the painter. But we haven't made that step in literature, and it becomes obviously far more complicated when a genre is titled nonfiction. And to go back to that issue of category, you know, the other problem is that nonfiction as a genre is, for lack of a better word, it's kind of a trash heap. I mean, it's everything that was left over after the gods created poetry and fiction and drama. You know, everything left, all of those celebrity autobiographies and all of the medical textbooks and journalism and committee meeting minutes. I mean, all of that stuff is nonfiction. And so I kind of get why journalists, especially, who have been the harshest critics of this book, would say that, you know, you're not following the rules. This is absolutely inappropriate. But it would be, you know, as ridiculous, I would say, for me, as, you know, I'm often called a so-called lyric essayist because I like to mix a lot of poetic forms with prose. It would be as ridiculous for me to announce and send a note to every journalist in America that, you know, from now on you have to follow the rules of lyric essays. I wouldn't do that because, one, I like journalism. I turn to it. I rely on it. We all rely on it as a kind of watchdog of our culture, of our elected officials and society leaders. I also wouldn't do it because it would be juvenile, because right. we need these varieties in literature. And so in some ways, we either need more categories or none at all.
Let's take a quick call from Phil, who's calling from Nantucket. Hi, Phil. Can you be brief with us?
Good afternoon. Yes. I'm a novelist who's written historical fiction, also written two memoirs about my own life. So I have to I completely side with the writer, I think, citing Napoleon's acerbic quote that history is a set of lies agreed upon. So I think the truth is a very malleable goop in this matter, and the poetry, as far as the readership, I think many people would prefer to read beautifully written atmospherics rather than chronically, detailing to the point of ad nauseum.
I take the point, Phil, but that said, you know, to come back to Jim, the fact checker, Jim, I feel like part of the reason that you were irked by the license that John took is that he was inventing facts about a real boy who killed himself.
Yeah, well, and it gets to the question of, you know, beyond journalism, I guess, this question of history, right, where there's history as narrative, but there's also, you know, historical practice as a science, right, where mm-hmm. There are similar rules to quote unquote rules to journalism, where you know there are sources and ways that you come to an agreement that something actually happened in the world. But then on the other hand, there are interpretations and there are analyses and there are narratives that come out of that, and that's a separate question.
Now, I briefly want to acknowledge something as we wrap up here that you guys don't talk about in the book, which is that this book is derived from your correspondence, but you guys actually went back and kind of punched up the dialogue, as it were. Does that complicate matters at all in your mind, Jim? I mean, you're the nitpicker in the bunch here.
Yeah, well, I guess it was intended to complicate things, so I hope that it does.
Oh, it's meta. I see. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not allowed to call that it that, but I'll accept if you
okay.
do. But yeah, I mean the as you might expect, neither John or I were as unprofessional as we come across in the book. But you know, in revisiting the fact-checking text and having this debate through the composition of the book, we sort of got at a lot of the sort of deeply held beliefs and the problems that we were thinking through during the fact-checking that, you know, we wouldn't have otherwise been able to have that dialogue.
Well, it's a phenomenal read, and I really do recommend it. My whole life I've been hearing that email is killing correspondence, and we're never going to have a book like the Adams Jefferson letters again, but this is one of them. It's an incredible document of correspondence. I just loved reading it. John Nagata is an author of creative writing and a teacher at the University of Iowa. Jim Fingal is his former fact checker. He's now a software designer here in the Boston area in Cambridge. Together, they are authors of The Life Span of a Fact. Got it right that time. We've got an excerpt of the book, and it's a beautifully designed book, too, so I encourage you to check it out. That's on our website, radioboston.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, One Irish Song Circle gets ready for St. Patrick's Day. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea with Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston.